Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chip Berlay, an author and researcher on racism and intolerance, who discusses the link between Donald Trump's toxic rhetoric and the recent spasm of politically driven violence across the U.S. Alexander Main of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who talks about the grave concern over the fate of Brazil after the country elected extremist right-wing candidate Jair Bolsonaro president. And Paul Rink, a Yale Law School student, who explains why he organized a rally in support of the Children's Climate Change lawsuit recently put on hold by the U.S. Supreme Court. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As the Palestinian-Israeli peace process has broken down, frustration has peaked, with more Arab citizens seeking to run for municipal office. Violating a 50-year Palestinian Authority boycott of local elections, Palestinian engineer and activist Ramadan Dabash is running for city council in East Jerusalem to fight for better streets and quality education for Palestinian children. Aziz Abu Sara, a Palestinian political and social activist, recently quit his effort to run for mayor of Jerusalem on a decidedly political anti-occupation platform after being pressured by both the Israeli and Palestinian sides to drop out. Local politicking is still a hard sell for many Palestinians because East Jerusalem is occupied land and participating in elections is seen by many Arabs as accepting Israeli domination. East Jerusalem is one of the poorest parts of either the West Bank or Israel. According to some estimates, as many as 70% of its Palestinian residents live below the poverty line. There is great bitterness over Israeli home demolitions that often follow the building of homes or extensions of homes by Palestinians without permits that East Jerusalemites claim are nearly impossible to procure from a city that views them as a demographic threat. On Election Day, November 6th, voters in the Republican-dominated state of Arkansas will vote on raising the minimum wage to $11 an hour by 2021. Today, only California and Massachusetts have a minimum wage as high as $11 per hour. The measure is popular. A state poll found 60% of voters are in favor of the idea. It nevertheless has been challenged by the state's Republican Attorney General and Arkansas's Chamber of Commerce. In 2014, when Arkansas voters raised their minimum wage to its current level from the federal floor of $7.25, those voters also elected Republicans across the board to state and federal office, despite the party's lack of support for the minimum wage increase. If voters again cast a ballot for an initiative that enjoys broad support while at the same time voting against the party that uniformly supports the measure, it might just be a sign of how tribal partisanship has become. Voters elect their representatives without regard for or even despite where they stand on some issues, part of an increasing pattern of red state voters casting their ballots against their own economic self-interest. In a shift since 2016, young Americans, according to recent polling, view socialism more favorably than capitalism. The public has been embracing ideas like Medicare for all and a federally guaranteed job, tilting the energy in the Democratic Party toward its progressive wing. Labor unions have been edging up in popularity and scored a ballot initiative win this year, even in Republican-dominated Missouri. There's growing support for worker ownership through worker cooperatives. If the 2011 Occupy Wall Street protest was a relatively short-lived movement, its spirit seems to be persisting and even expanding. Increasing support for progressive policy solutions among millennials has been inspired by massive student debt, sky-high rents, rising economic inequality, and growing poverty. The upset primary victory of Bronx native Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez put the resurgent Democratic Socialists of America on the political map. The DSA has recruited over 40,000 new members since Trump's election. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The past week has seen some of the worst politically driven violence in recent American history. On October 24th, a white supremacist with a history of violence shot and killed two African Americans at a Kroger grocery store after he attempted to gain entry into a black church outside Louisville, Kentucky. Just 2 days earlier, the first of 14 pipe bombs were discovered addressed to liberal Jewish philanthropist George Soros, who, along with the 13 other bombing targets, that included prominent Democratic Party officials and cable news network CNN, had been frequently vilified by President Trump. The Florida man, later arrested for sending the mail bombs, was an ardent Trump supporter who embraced many of the president's bogus conspiracy theories. Then on October 27th, a man carrying an AR-15 assault rifle and three handguns shot and killed 11 congregants at a Pittsburgh synagogue, wounding four police officers and two others, as he shouted, "All Jews must die." The Pittsburgh Synagogue Massacre, the deadliest attack on the Jewish community in U.S. history, was provoked by the gunman's belief in a conspiracy theory that a caravan of Central American refugees headed to the U.S. border was part of a Jewish plot. Your reporter spoke with Chip Berlay, an investigative journalist, research analyst, and activist who's written about racism and intolerance for over four decades. Here he examines the rise in hate crimes by violent right-wing individuals and groups and the connection of these crimes to President Trump's toxic, hateful rhetoric.
If a very popular leader who is high up, doesn't matter whether it's political or religious or movement leader, basically alleges that some group of people is conspiring against the common good, and they sort of harp on that for a long time, it's only a matter of time before people get killed. That has been the middle of the sociology of this kind of situation since the 1960s and 70s and 80s, and it tracks back to the research that was done into the Nazi movement.
And Chip, how directly can the current climate we're living through be traced to the rhetoric of one Donald Trump, who has certainly done his best to provoke people's fear and hatred as his campaign modus operandi? It really seems very deliberate, and it's worked very well for him.
Well, it's not clear if it's deliberate, because this is not the brightest star in the sky who is our president. So I think it's just his natural nastiness and bigotry that comes out whether or not he's president. My brother actually went to school with Donald Trump at New York Military Academy, and you know, in later years, he would admit that, as he would say, Donald Trump was a really good baseball player, not very smart, oh, and he was a bully and a jerk. So you come into this with the idea that he's a bully, and now he's president, and he's never really been in a position in his entire life, because of family wealth and elite rule, to be challenged on these ideas, so that he basically thinks that he can free form this kind of rhetoric without any sense of responsibility as a president, but without caring about the fact that he's coming across as a bigot.
Chip, I wanted to ask you in particular about a segment I saw on Fox News recently where Laura Ingraham, the host, was railing against the diseases that these immigrants who are traveling up from Central America, primarily Honduras and Guatemala through Mexico, and which has been a target for President Trump and the Fox News Network in recent days. She complained that these people would be bringing disease to the country. And I reflexively remembered in history that the Nazi Party targeted the minority groups that they were trying to demonize
with pretty much the same kind of broad brush saying that they carry diseases. And lo and behold, I looked it up. There it was. The whole history of the Nazi Party accusing various minority groups that were being persecuted by the Nazis as carrying disease. So Fox News tore a page right out of history here, a very dark history.
It's a vicious history. It's a genocidal history. You know, it's much better to use a hard word to describe this history. And in fact, if you go online and look up the Der Stürmer kind of records, that was the Nazi newspaper, and look at the language, look at the pictures, look at the characterization of Jews. They're not just disease carriers. They bring socialism. They bring rape. They bring all kinds of money manipulation. So we're basically now looking at people like Soros and seeing a direct historic relationship to the accusations against Soros, George Soros, with the Nazi movement of the 1930s. So it's really quite amazing that finally, when CNN came on 8 o'clock, they basically announced they weren't going to talk about the name of the shooter in Pittsburgh. They weren't going to talk about all these comments from political people. They're going to start by naming the victims. And I think that's really what has to happen. We spend so much time on the mainstream media talking about names, facts, killings, blood, and then we go to a cut to somebody who has a political or ideological point of view pontificating, right, you know, pulling it out of their butt. And talking about stuff they know nothing about. And all too much, even on the left media now, you have people talking about these kinds of actions and what promotes them without any knowledge that there's 50, 60 years of social science that explains all this in detail. It's just if it isn't on the web, it doesn't exist.
In the context of what we're living through right now, the extremists hate the racism and bigotry and the violence. How important, in your view, is this midterm election coming up November 6th in repudiating the politicians and party that seem to be promoting and advocating such hatred?
Well, it's a two-step process. You know, I think it's time to take power away from the very bizarre set of authoritarian and self-referential Republicans who have taken over the party. There's really four or five different sectors of the right that have united to support Trump and the current libertarian kind of greedster agenda, but also very masculinist, also very anti kind of intellectual. So I think we need to elect Democrats, not because we think they're going to solve the problem, but because, you know, we'd like to be able to have these conversations in 2 years rather than all being, you know, sitting around in a camp somewhere talking about the revolution or the Democrats or whether Hillary was the right person to pick. I think we need to stop what's happening now. That's crucial, and that's going to be by electing Democrats, but that is not the solution in the long run. And the solution in the long run is to start organizing resistance to all these forms of authoritarianism and bigotry.
That was Chip Berlay, an investigative journalist, research analyst, and activist who's written about racism and intolerance for over four decades. Learn more about the link between toxic racist rhetoric and hate crimes by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Following years of political and economic upheaval, Brazilians went to the polls on October 28th and elected Jair Bolsonaro president, who as a candidate praised his nation's military dictatorship, advocated torture, and frequently made misogynistic, racist, and homophobic remarks. Bolsonaro, who won Brazil's second-round election, 55-45%, over the center-left Workers' Party candidate Fernando Haddad, threatened to destroy, jail, or drive into exile his political opponents. He's also pledged to open up the fragile Amazon rainforest to development and pull Brazil out of the Paris Climate Accords. Bolsonaro's victory comes after conservative political forces in Brazil succeeded in impeaching Workers' Party President Dilma Rousseff in 2016 and imprisoning former Workers' Party President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva on dubious corruption charges, who polls indicated would have won the presidency again if he'd been permitted to run. Brazil's lurch to the right with the election of Bolsonaro follows the rise of extreme right-wing politicians across Latin America, Europe, and the United States. Your reporter spoke with Alexander Main, Director of International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who discusses grave concerns over the fate of South America's largest nation under Bolsonaro and the political and social movements that have vowed to challenge his authoritarian agenda.
Once Lula was out of the equation, you had no sort of major popular figures in Brazilian politics that could sort of take on Bolsonaro, who did a good job as posing as a complete outsider, as not being corrupt, as someone who would help clean up Brazil in a variety of ways. Very aggressive rhetoric towards his left-wing adversaries that he would jail or force into exile, and even at times has threatened to execute them, labeling others as terrorists and so on. But one further point, which I think really needs to be emphasized, and it's interesting because people like Steve Bannon have actually praised the Bolsonaro campaign on this very point, which is that they were very successful in spreading all sorts of disinformation about Haddad, about the rival candidate from the Workers' Party, through social media, primarily WhatsApp, which is very heavily used in Brazil. Essentially, they had an army of trolls putting out all sorts of fake news in a very, very effective way. They managed to reach millions of Brazilians, and much of what was put out there was taken at face value.
Alex, Bolsonaro is elected to office on a pledge of many repressive and authoritarian programs that he intends to put in place. Tell us about the checks and balances in the Brazilian system, namely the legislative branch. There were elections for the legislative branch as well in the first round of the elections, I believe. And the Workers' Party, as I understand it, will play a prominent role in the Brazilian Congress.
Well, Scott, not necessarily, because while they have more seats than any other party, they are far from having the majority of seats. And in fact, when you look at who won, you know, there's no single party that has a majority. And Bolsonaro's party is actually second. It went from having literally two or three members in the Brazilian parliament to having 52. I think to the Workers' Party, I believe they have around 57 at this point. But you have many, many parties, and actually when you do the math, you can see that the right has really the strongest coalition in the parliament, or what is assumed will be a future coalition. In terms of the broader checks and balances, including from the judiciary and so on, you know, let's note that the judiciary is extremely, extremely conservative, has shown itself to sort of been playing a partisan role against the Workers' Party in these various corruption investigations. And, you know, there's a good chance that they will soften up to Bolsonaro. And should they not, there's a real threat from the military, I think.
Alex, tell us about the social movements in Brazil that have been very active in pushing progressive policies and working with the former incumbent party, the Workers' Party, in raising the standard of living for millions of Brazilians. How are they likely to react to a Bolsonaro presidency?
Well, they're reacting very badly and quite understandably. I mean, Bolsonaro just last week labeled some of the major social movements, including the MST, the Landless Workers Movement, and also the MTST, the movement of people without homes, of homeless people, to enormous urban and rural movements that have been very organized and, as you said, have been sort of involved in pushing progressive policies. He's labeled them as terrorists. You know, once you do that, you can, you know, essentially you have carte blanche to really carry out widespread repression and jailings and so on. Already over the last 2 years, certainly the Landless Workers Party has been targeted by the police, targeted by right-wing militias. They've had leaders assassinated. They've had a number of people jailed without justification. So we can expect this to get worse. Interestingly, Bulos, who was a candidate in the first round of the elections for a left-wing party called the PSOL, he is also the leader of the MTST, of the Homeless People's Movement. And he came out with a very strong statement after the election of Bolsonaro, saying, "We will not be jailed. We will not be forced out of the country. Again, two things that Bolsonaro said he would do with his left-wing opponents. Instead, Bulos said, we will take to the streets. And I expect we're going to see a very strong organized movement. I fear there could be violent repression of this movement. And I think it's really time for the world to pay more attention to what's going on in Brazil, because things could get bad very quickly.
That was Alexander Main, Director of International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Learn more about the current political crisis in Brazil by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. October 29th was to be the start date of what's been dubbed the trial of the century, in which 21 youth plaintiffs are suing the U.S. federal government for its failure to protect them from climate change and are demanding a climate protection plan. Instead, the case known as Juliana versus United States was put on hold by the U.S. Supreme Court while it reviews yet another appeal from the Trump administration to throw the case out based on the cost of the trial to the government. It should be noted that the case was initially filed by Our Children's Trust as a civil rights case under the Obama administration, which also tried to block it. An earlier appeal by the Trump administration was denied by the Supreme Court last summer, so plaintiffs are hopeful that this will just be another temporary delay. Rallies were organized across the country in support of the Children's Trust lawsuit on October 29th, originally planned to coincide with the start of the trial. However, with the case on hold, protests were instead held in support of the youth's ongoing legal battles and to demand that the case be allowed to proceed. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Paul Rink, a third-year student in a joint degree program at Yale Law School and the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. Here, Rink explains why he organized a support rally for the lawsuit in New Haven, Connecticut, and what he hopes will be accomplished in the case.
I wanted to organize the rally because I worked for Our Children's Trust over the summer, and I find the work that they're doing in supporting this case really inspirational. I mentioned at the rally that I see climate change as a social justice and a human rights issue, and this case kind of really speaks to that in a very tangible and direct way that I find really motivating.
This lawsuit, Juliana versus United States, was filed in 2015. Can you give us some of the background?
Julia Olson, the lead attorney, has been filing similar litigation for maybe 8 years. And in doing so, she's kind of come up with a really strong legal argument and framework for a case. And that was what led to Juliana versus the United States. Kelsey Juliana is a young woman who lives in Eugene, Oregon, and her family, her parents are very involved in the activist community there. And so she immediately latched onto the case when she heard about it. Julia's attorney and Kelsey Juliana, the plaintiff, kind of reached out to their networks and found more plaintiffs, and so they have the 21 plaintiffs that are part of the case. In terms of the procedural history of what's happened in the court, the case hasn't even gone to trial yet. What's happened is, they filed the claim, and then the government filed some motions that would keep it from going to court. There are a number of motions they can file, and they filed basically everything they could think of to try to keep it from going to the courtroom. And the years in between 2015 and now were kind of all of that happening in terms of the district court hearing, what the government had to say about why the case shouldn't go to trial, and then Judge Aiken saying, no, the case should go to trial. And then the government subsequently appealing that decision by Judge Aiken at the circuit level and then the Supreme Court level. So over 3 years, the trial hasn't even begun yet.
The 21 plaintiffs represent a wide diversity of ages, ethnicities, and locations from across the country. The youth were between 9 and 18 years old when the lawsuit was filed. And I've interviewed several of them, and every one has been very well informed and articulate. you know, which just reinforces my belief that it's young people who are taking the lead on the fight to preserve life as we know it on Earth. And of course, they have the most to lose. I worked with Kelsey Juliana, the lead plaintiff, in a week of action in D.C. back in 2014 after she had participated in the cross-country Great March for Climate Action. And what impressed me, besides her commitment and her intelligence, was her joie de vivre. I remember her singing and dancing around the room as we did our training for nonviolent civil disobedience. Paul Rink, do you know if the intention was to recruit such a diverse group?
I don't believe there was an intention to come up with a certain number. What I do know is they wanted the majority of the plaintiffs to be in Eugene for jurisdictional purposes. The goal was to file the case in the Eugene District Court because they believed they had the best shot of getting a favorable ruling in that particular district. And so I think 11 of the 21 plaintiffs are from Oregon. But then, like you said, there's a lot of geographical spread in terms of the other plaintiffs. And they were recruited either by reaching out to the Our Children's Trust themselves or by hearing about it through word of mouth and being recruited by Julia.
What will happen if the youth win their lawsuit?
If they were to win, the government would be required to come up with a climate action recovery plan, which is desperately needed. But in a lot of senses, I think the power of this case lies less in whether it wins or loses, and much more so in creating this very tangible ethical plea to have a greater spread of the public within the United States and abroad, not only trust that climate change is actually happening, but believe that it's something that needs to be acted upon. I think there's something really visceral about seeing these children stand up to their government for their right to life in the future. It kind of makes a really strong moral narrative that I find very motivating and I think has the potential to tap into a lot of people that maybe beforehand had not considered climate change to be as big of an issue. And even if it doesn't make them change their mind completely about what they're going to do about climate change, maybe it would plant the seed that would create change in the future in their minds and hearts.
That was Paul Rink, an organizer of one of the scores of rallies held across the U.S. on October 29th in support of a youth-led lawsuit against the U.S. government for its failure to take action on climate change. Learn more about the Children's Trust lawsuit by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on RECFM in Riverton, Maryland, KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, KKRN in Round Mountain, California, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.